This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It's not Albert Einstein's birthday. It's not the anniversary of his arrival in America. It's not 100 years since his famous E equals MC squared equation. No matter, no less than 6 new books on Einstein, his life, his works, are coming out this spring and summer, and Lord knows there are probably a lot more in the works on the presses ready to be released. So what is it about Einstein that continues to inspire historians to examine his life and scientists to challenge his work? That's what we'll be talking about this hour with the author of 3 of those new Einstein books. We'll also hear about the Einstein Papers Project. This is a very interesting project. It's a searchable archive right on the internet where you can surf through Einstein's writings, and you can even check out his travel diary. Well, it may be a little late to book that trip, but what do you think about Einstein? What about his figure, his popular figure? Has it gotten better in your eyes, or has he been degraded a little bit with the publications of all these new books and past books in the last few years? Is it getting too much exposure, as they would say in the media these days? Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Thomas Levinson is author of Einstein in Berlin, published by Bantam Books. He's an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning TV producer. His credits include a 2-hour biography of Einstein for PBS's Nova program. He joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Good to see you, Tom.
Good to be here. Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Barry Parker is the author of Einstein, The Passions of a Scientist, published by Prometheus. He's professor emeritus of physics at Idaho State University, and he joins us from Pocatello. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Parker.
Yes, good to be here.
Thank you
for inviting me.
You're welcome. Peter L. Gallison is the Mallinckrodt Professor of the History of Science and of Physics at Harvard University. His forthcoming book is Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time, published by Norton. He joins us by phone. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Gallison.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Tom, let me start off with you first, because you wrote a commentary on that Nova webpage about the parlor game physics students play, who's the greatest genius. And you say that the answer has to be Einstein because of a 20-year period of creativity that he went through, unmatched in the world of science. Tell us about why you voted that way.
Well, Einstein is almost, in essence, the last of the great physicists to complete an entire system of thought on his own. I mean, nowadays, as Peter can tell you in great detail, I'm sure, most of physics is a big enterprise, you know. A few dozens, even hundreds of physicists will work on a problem or a project or experiment. Einstein did it by himself, and he did it really by himself in his early years. At the patent office, when he did special relativity, he founded the quantum theory of light. He did fundamental work on statistical physics that had actually important implications for industry even today. All that in 1905. He was 26 years old. He was not working in a university. He was a patent examiner, assessing things for the Swiss government. Mm-hmm. He went on to realize the need, based on his earlier work in special relativity, for a new theory of gravity, the work that became the general theory of relativity in 1907, still at the patent office. He continued to work on quantum problems. He continued to work on statistical physics, even answering the question of why the sky is blue in a paper in 1910 or 11. And then in 1915, he began a year-and-a-half period, which was his most, in some ways, his most astonishing period of creativity, when he did more fundamental work on quantum theory, including some of the first descriptions of a chance-ridden universe. He invented the science of cosmology in a single paper, and most famously, of course, he finished the general theory of relativity. He invented the theory of gravity that still is the one we use today. And that defines the entire universe. Amazingly enough, after a 10-year run from 1905 to 1915, he kept going, and despite illness, hardship, political turmoil, the war still going on around him. And he was doing first-class science, really important science, up till about 1925. And you will find very, very few scientists today, if any, who continue to have that level of productivity, output, and importance for 2 solid decades.
Mm-hmm. Peter Gallison, in your book, Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time, you mentioned that you had a very interesting, event that happened to you, sort of an inspiration for the book, that happened in a railroad station that sort of set your mind to thinking about Einstein.
Yeah, so Einstein began one of his perhaps the most famous paper of the 20th century in physics by using a metaphor and saying that he imagined if you wanted to know what time was, you could imagine, for instance, a train coming into a station and in front of you, arriving just in front of you, look at your watch. If the little hand's pointing to the 7, he said the train arrives at 7. But what he asked would it mean if a train arrived at a distant station and you wanted to say that that was simultaneous with something in your station? And then he went on to figure out a way to coordinate clocks between different points, and it was the key to cracking the final key to cracking the problem of special relativity. He'd had the other parts in place for some time, and he could then proceed. And I've always wondered where that metaphor came from. What was it about, and why did it matter that he was working in a patent office 60, 70 hours a week? And doing this physics, was there a link between them? There are certain things that we know. For instance, his work on using gyroscopes to make compasses helped shape his ideas about the nature of the atom and magnetism. But I was standing in a train station one day, and I noticed a series of beautiful old clocks in a European train station, and they seemed to be moving along pretty much in synchrony. And then I noticed, and I thought, these are good clocks. Then I noticed that the second hands were clicking along exactly in synchrony. And I thought, these aren't good clocks. These are synchronized clocks. I wonder if Einstein saw synchronized clocks in train stations. And I went back to the States and started poking around the old patent records that were going through the patent office to the section, the kind of work that Einstein was interested in, and saw that there was, in fact, a huge industry of coordinating clocks electrically in train stations and along train tracks. And that led me to start to think about how the broader technologies and concerns with simultaneity, very practical matters of coordinating clocks across oceans to make maps for Einstein's competitor Poincaré, the great mathematician and philosopher, how all of this worked and how these metaphors could both be about physics at its most abstract and philosophical and at the same time about things altogether practical. And that's where I began the study for this book.
So you think that possibly seeing all these patent applications about clocks coming across his mind might have primed his pump to think about this a little more?
I think we have to think about these metaphors that Einstein uses as being at once really pure thought experiments, as abstract as can be, but also they come from a world in which coordinated clocks and train stations and understanding the meaning of simultaneity and what a convention of simultaneity would be understood to be, and even some of the technical details of that did matter. And so Einstein is really at the intersection of these different concerns, practical, philosophical, and physical.
Now, one of his jobs at being an examiner in the patent office, was it not to write comments on the papers of the filers, the patent applications? Well, this is good, that's bad, this is, make little comments on the papers?
There was, and in fact, he thought of that, his work in the patent office, as being a kind of a training. He was apprenticed to a man named Friedrich Haller, a great patent examiner himself, and Haller really taught Einstein to critically read these patents, to challenge everything, to never assume that the patent writer was correct. Mm-hmm. And this fit very well with Einstein's own sort of rebellious and critical attitude towards the world. But we do see some of the remnants of that. Most of the papers that Einstein was engaged with were destroyed 18 years after they were written, even though then in 1923 Einstein was the most famous scientist in the world by far.
All those comments on the papers were burned?
Almost all of them were burned, except those that went into litigation. And Einstein, in fact, was in court several times testifying about patent priorities. And he, in fact, became so interested in the patent world, he took out his own patents. Einstein had patents on refrigerators and patents on gyrocompasses. He collected royalties. And he often commented to his friends that learning to think through patents was important to him scientifically.
Mm. Barry Parker, being a rebel like that, is that important to be a good scientist?
Oh, I think it very definitely is important. Einstein, certainly when he was very young, was considered a rebel. For example, at school, he had all kinds of problems. Even when he went to university, for example, he was certainly considered a rebel. A lot of his teachers didn't like him. Minkowski referred to him as a lazy dog. Later on, he didn't get along with Weber very well, primarily because Weber didn't teach Maxwell's electromagnetic theory. So he certainly was a rebel of types. There's no doubt about that.
Would he be today with all the exposure that scientists get, especially scrutinizing people's public lives and the scandals that Einstein went through with his love life, which we'll get into a little bit later, would he be able to survive that kind of scrutiny today? I'll ask all three of you. What do you think, Tom?
Well, Einstein really was the person who launched, was really present at the creation in the formation of the celebrity culture. When general relativity was confirmed by measuring the bending of starlight around the sun during a total eclipse in 1919, Einstein became the first celebrity of science, first international celebrity. Mm-hmm. He was in the newsreels. He was photographed so much that once he was, the one time he wasn't recognized, somebody said, "What did he do for a living?" And he said he was a photographer's model. Comments that he made, in passing as a joke, in one country would appear across the Atlantic within a day or two and get him into trouble. He once, after his first visit to the United States, told a Dutch reporter that the American men were lapdogs of their women and Americans were colossally bored. And these quotes ended up in the New York Times within a day or two, and he had some serious backtracking to do.
Well, he was certainly no lapdog of his women that he was going out with, was he?
Oh, no. But, I mean, if you ask could he have survived the scrutiny, I think, he learned better than most and certainly ahead of virtually all of his peers who criticized him for the amount of publicity he got. He learned how to not just, exist under the scrutiny, but even when necessary, to take advantage of it for his own ends.
And that was as an age at the turn of the century there where science was – scientists in the age of Thomas Edison, inventors were really looked up to at that turn of the century. I mean, there was a story that Sarah Bernhardt, when she first came on a trip to the United States, on a theatrical trip from Great Britain – the first person she went to was Thomas Edison to have her picture taken with him because that was a great way to get publicity. Can you imagine something like that happening today? We're coming in to see a scientist. Madonna going to a scientist to have her picture taken with him because that was, the difference in the times back then.
Well, think of the adulation that, say, a Stephen Hawking gets. But certainly, Einstein had the same thing happen to him. He went to a premiere in Hollywood in 30 or 31, I believe, and an attractive young woman walked up to him and said, "Oh, Dr. Einstein, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just have to shake your hand." And he did so, and he made some small talk. And afterwards, he turned to his companion and said, "Who was that?" And it was Mary Pickford. You can't imagine anyone not recognizing Ms. Pickford back in that day. But Einstein had his own priorities.
On the other hand, you write in your book, and you tell interesting stories about Einstein and his first and second, his wife. And you have very interesting quotes. On matters of love and marriage, you write that Einstein was, quote, a hypocrite as well as an emotional imbecile.
Well, those are strong words, intentionally so.
Yeah.
Einstein himself said, and I'm paraphrasing his quote, but it was something to the order of he was deeply committed to humanity in the mass. It was individuals he had trouble with. I think the story of his first marriage is sort of an ordinary sadness. He married very young. He married his college sweetheart. He married the woman by whom he had a daughter out of wedlock, of whose fate nothing is known. She disappears from the scene before 1905. And that marriage fell apart. Abraham Pais, perhaps Einstein's best technical biographer and a friend of Einstein's, reports that Einstein went into that marriage with mental reservations. But certainly by the 1907, 1908, something like that, after only being married for 5 or 6 years, there were clear strains, and it fell apart. And Einstein's move to Berlin was the lever he used to take a relationship that had clearly disintegrated and blow it apart.
All right. Well, Tom, hold that thought, because we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about Einstein's personal life with Thomas Levinson, Barry Parker, and Peter Gallison, all authors of new and interesting books about Einstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about Albert Einstein with new books being published and a lot of attention. The 100th anniversary of that miracle year, 1905, is coming up, and I imagine that's some of the reasons why we're seeing lots of new books coming out. My guests are Thomas Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, published by Bantam Books, Barry Parker, author of Einstein, The Passions of a Scientist, published by Prometheus, and Peter L. Gallison, author of a forthcoming book, Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time, published by Norton, and that's due out in August. And while I rudely interrupted Tom, he was telling us about Einstein's love life and what a disaster that turned out to be in some cases.
It was you know, you wouldn't have wanted a woman you cared about to be emotionally dependent on Einstein, because it wasn't a happy thing. His second marriage and the lead up to his second marriage was where most of the really hurtful, damaging emotional actions of Einstein came. He really led his second wife, Elsa Einstein, a cousin of his, for a merry dance, even briefly considering apparently choosing to marry her daughter by a previous marriage rather than Elsa herself.
That was a fantastic part of your book. You say it was almost a toss-up. He could have gone either way. I'll take either one of them. Maybe let them decide who I should marry.
That was in one of the you'll be talking to the head of the Papers Project. One of the most extraordinary letters to be published in one of the earlier volumes of the Einstein Papers was a letter from Ilse Einstein, Elsa's daughter, ultimately Einstein's stepdaughter, to a close friend of her mother's and a former lover of her own, a man named Nikolai, trying to get some advice about what she should do, because Einstein had apparently told them, allowed them to believe, that he would marry either Elsa or Ilse. He didn't care which, and he would allow the two women to decide. And one of the reasons he didn't care is he didn't take marriage that seriously. He wanted comfort. He wanted somebody to cook for him. He wanted somebody to take care of him. And he enjoyed sex, apparently, and he would get his sex life wherever he chose. And when he ultimately did marry Elsa, that was the bargain. She couldn't complain when he had affairs. And when she did try to complain, he stormed at her, according to contemporary reports. And it's interesting. There's been a lot of scrutiny of Einstein's personal life, and probably your other guests have some thoughts about this as well. But one of the interesting things that it raises is how much do we now, 50 years after his death, 80, 90 years after the events in question, care about that when we look at a man whose scientific, public, political life was of such importance through such an important time in the history of the 20th century. It's a measure in some senses of ourselves how much we care about his mm-hmm. sex life, given that all the mm-hmm. people it helped or hurt are now dead.
Mm-hmm. Let me, in that vein, about keeping up with what Einstein's archives are, let me bring in Diana Buchwald, who is associate professor of history at Caltech and general editor and director of the Einstein Papers Project. She joins us from Caltech in Pasadena. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Buchwald.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Einstein papers. How many are they? Are they online now? What is the collection comprised of?
The collection is significant. The collection comprises material that was left by Einstein in his home and in his office upon his death in Princeton, New Jersey, when he was member of the Institute for Advanced Study, where he lived for 22 years. And then the collection was expanded significantly, in particular through the very devoted services of his long-term assistant and secretary, Helen Dukas, mm-hmm. who continued to collect material until the early 1980s. And according to Einstein's last will and testament, which he wrote in 1950, he bequeathed his entire literary estate to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And therefore, Helen Dukas packed all these materials, both originals and photocopies that she had collected from various correspondents of Einstein all over the world over a period of 27 years, and those were transferred to the Jewish National and University Library at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Now, since the early 1980s, a large number of editors and scholars of the Einstein Papers Project have accumulated additional material. Again, from various repositories, the Royal Society, the Prussian Academy of Sciences, libraries in Berlin and Holland, the personal papers of people with whom Einstein corresponded, for example, Paul Ehrenfest in Holland and many others, the Max Born, and so on. And so we now work with a collection of approximately 62,000 items that are by Einstein, to Einstein, or about Einstein. This is right now the grand number.
Wow. And so this is all searchable on the Internet?
Now, the original Einstein archive is searchable on the Internet, on the website that we just released on Monday.
Mm. And what is your most...
About 43,000 items, yes.
Wow. Well, tell us one of your favorite things on the archive.
Well, on the website, some of the more beautiful things that haven't been published are, for example, Einstein's travel diary to the United States He leaves Germany in late 1930, arrives in California at the end of December 1930, comes to visit Caltech as a visiting scientist in winter term of 1931. And we present to the general public, as well as to the scholars, of course, his America, Reise 1931, 1931, in a beautiful leather-bound travel diary with the gold-edged leaves. The two manuscripts that are at the Hebrew University Archives that contain the formula E equals MC squared might be of interest to the general public. They were actually written much later, in 1946. Einstein wrote an article that was published in Science Illustrated where he reconstructed his path to the special theory of relativity. There is no 1905 manuscript of this foundational paper.
Because?
Because, as far as the editors have been aware, Einstein didn't keep his manuscript. He was only 26 years old. He was a young man. He probably sent it to the publisher, never got it back. The publisher never kept it, and Einstein didn't keep his drafts. It is only after 1914, in particular, that Einstein starts to keep manuscripts. And it's only in the early 20s that he has a secretary. And therefore, much of the earlier material is not available at all.
Yeah, he wasn't a very famous person to begin with. He was working, as we say, working in the patent office as a simple clerk and didn't probably think to keep some of these papers.
He probably didn't think to keep some of these papers. In addition, he moved quite a bit in his early life. He went to Prague. He went back to Zurich. And also... he wasn't really well known to the scientific community before 1919. There were maybe 100 physicists, distinguished in themselves, of course, but he was certainly not a world-famous scientist.
Yeah.
He becomes that only around 1920.
Diana Buchwald, thank you very much for joining us, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to be searching that archive now that we've been listening to the program today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Diana Buchwald, Associate Professor of History at Caltech, and she's the General Editor and Director of the Einstein's Papers Project, which you can now search online and weed through them, and some very interesting stuff there. Let me introduce my other guest. Barry Parker is author of Einstein, The Passions of a Scientist, Thomas Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, and Peter L. Gallison, author of the forthcoming book, Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time, published by Norton. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's get some phone calls in while we still can. Let's go to Fairbanks. Harry in Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi, Harry.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm doing fine, and I wanted to quote Einstein and say that I used that quotation to inspire me to discover some avenues that might lead to, without being pompous or anything, peace on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. And so what is our worst problem? Well, all the perplexities and confusion and distress in America and the world arise not from defects in our Constitution or Confederation, not from want of honor or virtue so much as from downright ignorance as to the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. That's a quote, too, from President John Adams, and I'd been contemplating that a long time when I read this thing about Einstein. I've got bunches of books on Einstein, and it led me to a big flaw in our society that has affected almost everything we do and can create. And if you give me just a moment,
I'll give you just a few more seconds because we have other calls to get to, Harry.
Well, never mind then.
No, go ahead. Tell us.
Well, there's two kinds of wealth on Earth. There's permanent and perishable. There's the fishing pole is permanent, and the fish you catch, which is perishable. The glass you drink the milk from is permanent, and the milk, of course, is perishable. And wealth is what we use to enable mankind. And our money is just a ticket to wealth. It should have no value. It shouldn't be able to be bought and sold and change in value. It's just a ticket. And we've allowed the ticket makers to decide how much wealth we've created. And when we get past that problem, we'll find a rosier, shinier, much sunnier earth than we have today by far.
Thanks for
That's
calling.
All I wanted to say.
Thanks for calling. Have a happy weekend.
Thank you. Same to you.
Bye-bye. What about Einstein as a pacifist? Where did that come from, Tom? Where did he get this?
Well, Einstein's political views were shaped by no event more than the outbreak of World War I and the reaction of his colleagues, the people he really loved, like Max Planck, close friends like Haber, the great chemist, and the German scientists whom he had come to Berlin to really, share the scientific wealth with. And when he saw his close colleagues turn into, raving nationalist jingoists, praising the use of German arms, defending Germany against admitted atrocities, he began a real political commitment that I don't think had been there in anything like the same degree beforehand. But what's interesting is he wasn't always a pacifist. At first in World War I, he was mostly an internationalist. He was against the war. He thought it was stupid. But what he really worked for and wrote about and tried to make happen was some preservation of the international ties among the elite of which he was a part, the elite of the mind, the elite of scientists, which he had seen torn asunder by the rabid nationalism of his close friends and others. During the 20s, he became a true pacifist of the Bertrand Russell stripe, a person morally absolutely committed to the principle that violence under any circumstances was unacceptable. He said once, "I would rather die than be part of such murderous business."
But yet, when it came to signing that letter to Roosevelt warning about the Nazis developing the atom bomb, he went ahead and did that.
Absolutely. The rise and triumph of Hitler. I mean, one of the things you got to remember is Einstein really wasn't stupid. He wasn't the naive, woolly-headed, well-wishing, political naïf that he's sometimes been painted as. He was a hard-headed, clear-thinking man in spheres other than just physics. He saw in Hitler the real danger that Hitler presented, the real catastrophe that Hitler was, long before allegedly much more hard-headed men and women came to realize that. Almost as soon as Hitler took power in 1933, Einstein began speaking out against him, speaking out in defense of refugees, and broke with the true pacifists he had been associated with as little as a year or so before, saying, no, with Hitler's different. He's not going to be persuaded away by nice words. He's going to need to be opposed. And so when Szilard and Teller and others went out to Long Island to get Albert Einstein to sign that letter to Roosevelt saying, we've got to look into this atomic bomb business, he was absolutely willing to do this. He thought that the notion of Hitler with the bomb was completely unacceptable. And even the horrific notion of developing a bomb to defend against that prospect, that was a moral risk he was willing to take then.
Mm-hmm. Peter Gallison, is Einstein still, is his reputation still intact scientifically? I mean, people have been trying to unite, his theories of relativity with quantum mechanics. He sort of invented quantum mechanics, and then he sort of disowned it, saying it wasn't the final answer. And people are still trying to unite those theories.
Yes, they are. And I think that there are different ways in which Einstein still remains relevant and has been over the last 100 years. One is that the ideas that he brought to our understanding of space and time back in 1905 and then through the development of general relativity formed not only intrinsically crucial aspects of modern physics that remain with us, but also they became models for our understanding of other concepts. Einstein said, as I mentioned, that if you wanted to say what simultaneity was, you had to see how to actually coordinate clocks by the exchange of signals. And when people in the quantum revolution, Heisenberg and Bohr and others, criticized the idea of causality and the other fundamental breaks that quantum mechanics represented, they used Einstein's work as a model. Now, Einstein was quite hesitant about all that. He once said famously that a good joke shouldn't be repeated too many times when he was thinking about what had happened with quantum mechanics based on his own theories. But nonetheless, these were models of how to think physically. They became exemplars of a rigorous, operationalized sense of what it meant to have scientific concepts at all. In that sense, not only was it important for itself, but it was important as a model. And then finally, as you mentioned, the creation of general relativity, one of the truly beautiful theories of physics, was and remains incompletely brought together with quantum mechanics, and the tensions that that created, in some sense, remain at the very center of the effort of those theorists today working on string theory, on trying to unite the elementary particle physics that was the triumph of the 1960s and 70s with our understanding of gravity at the largest scale, including black holes and the cosmogenesis of the universe itself. So these questions that Einstein raised, his ways of understanding, the theories that he created, the models for what knowledge would be like, stand today still. And if you ask string theorists to talk about what they're doing, it very often comes back to Einstein. They'll talk about the tension between relativity and quantum mechanics and what Einstein's dream of unification was, how it has to be modified in certain ways, important ways, to form string theory. But also they look at Einstein's solitary quest for general relativity with minimal data and observations to support it in the first years, there's much more since then, as a kind of inspiration for their own hopes at unification now.
We're talking
Einstein remains an icon, even within the physics community in many respects.
Talking about Einstein this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did he die of, and I'll ask all of you, let me start with Barry Parker, did he die of feeling defeated? I want to get to that question, but I want to throw it out and then come back to it because we're going to have to take a break. Thinking that, you know, trying to not come up, being unsuccessful at this grand unified theory, did he die thinking, I have failed in my life and it's there's something to go on to? Don't answer because we have to take a break. We're going to come back and take a short break and we'll tackle that weighty problem, and the unfinished desire by Einstein at the end of his life to come up with the unified theory. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note, join Neil Conan in this hour on Monday for a discussion of this summer's best books, plus the virtues of being lazy. That's on Monday's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about Albert Einstein with my guest, Thomas Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, published by Bantam, Barry Parker, author of Einstein, The Passions of a Scientist, published by Prometheus, and Peter L. Gallison, who is author of the forthcoming book, Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time. That's going to be coming from out in Norton in August. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And before the break, I threw out the question. Maybe Barry Parker could answer it first. Was Einstein disappointed, or was he? Must have been disappointed, I imagine. But was he a broken person for not coming up with the unified field theories and the theory of everything?
It's rather interesting that on the very last day that he was alive, he was in the hospital and everything, and he still asked for his notes, and he was still working on a new unified field theory. I think the big disappointment for him was that early in his life, when he worked on something, he made big breakthroughs, and then suddenly after a few years after general relativity, he started working on unified theory. He wanted to kind of join together quantum theory and general relativity, really generalized general relativity, so it included quantum theory, included all the forces of nature, particularly electromagnetic theory. But a big disappointment was that it took him, he worked on it for a period of 30 years and didn't really make any big breakthrough. I think the people working with him frequently got a little bit disappointed. A few of them actually kind of left because he would work on a theory for a while and finally see that there was a flaw in the theory, and the next day he would just start on a completely new theory and be working on it also. So he never gave up. He had a tremendous, he kept going all the time, but he had to have been disappointed probably in the very end, because he had hoped that he disliked quantum theory. He wanted to show that general relativity somehow included quantum theory. Nowadays, of course, it's the other way around. Most people are working from the quantum theory end and somehow want to incorporate general relativity into quantum theory. But those are the two great theories, quantum theory and general relativity now in physics, and there's no bridge between them. And this is one of the major problems of physics at the present time.
Let's go to the phones to Brad in Burlington, Washington. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
Hi there.
My question is about the uncertainty principle. About 20 years ago, I took an advanced physics class, which included special and general relativity. And shortly after that, I read a book that, in my feeling, was it hijacked the uncertainty principle to proclaim a certain approach to philosophy. And I wondered what Einstein himself would have had to say about that notion of hijacking the uncertainty principle, and whether or not he might have had some kind of philosophical opinions about that.
You mean God playing dice with the universe?
Exactly.
The whole objection to quantum mechanics.
Exactly.
Anybody want to take a crack at that?
Well, I think this is Peter Galison.
Yes.
I think there's one important point that's sometimes misunderstood about Einstein, and that is he didn't think quantum mechanics was wrong in the sense that it led to wrong predictions about the world. He didn't think that it was a failure to be immensely useful in physics. He knew it was, and he contributed in fundamental ways to it. But he didn't think it was a complete theory. He didn't think it was the end of the story, and I think this is what Barry was getting at in his last comment. He hoped that there would be a way, in a sense, of explaining why quantum mechanics looked the way it did with a theory that had more of the characteristics of what he wanted in a theory, that objects behaved in some localized way, that they didn't have the bizarre behaviors of quantum mechanics in some sense at the most underlying level of explanation. But it wasn't. He didn't think that it led to errors, in the sense of wrong predictions of particular experiments. That was not his objection.
As a matter of fact, he nominated the people for that came up with quantum mechanics for the Nobel Prize. So he obviously had tremendous. He thought a lot of them, obviously.
Tremendous, and he said at one point he spent over many times many much.
Yeah,
he much more time working on quantum theory than he did on relativity.
Yeah, he said,
and
I spent 100 times as much time.
When he first heard of Bohr's discovery in some of the early quantum theory, he had one question. He said, does this explain the lines in spectroscopy? And when he was told yes, he said, then it's one of the greatest discoveries of all time. So he knew this was tremendously important. And I think it was its incompleteness that worried him. He didn't think it was the last word. It didn't. What he often used to say is he wanted to know how much choice God had at the beginning of the universe, in some sense. He wanted to know what the ultimate answers to things were in physics. Mm-hmm. And that was what he didn't think quantum mechanics.
He didn't like a probability theory. He didn't like the indeterminacy associated with quantum mechanics, because he was a classicalist at heart, in which exact answers were obtained. So,
Tom Levinson?
One of the things that Barry and Peter have both touched on is people don't realize how important Einstein was to the creation of quantum theory. He's the second of the three great thinkers who made the first quantum theory. Max Planck was the first. Einstein, in 1905, created the quantum theory of light. He even won the Nobel Prize not for relativity. I mean, people think, oh, it's special relativity or general relativity. It's not. He was awarded the prize for his contributions to physics, especially in the explanation of the photoelectric effect, which is his paper that is the foundation of the quantum theory of light. And Einstein was also, he was certainly classically inclined, but he was a really skilled, very, very good statistical physicist. And he understood long before people like Born or, before Heisenberg was out of high school, but long before Born or Heisenberg or Schrodinger or any of the others, he really understood that there were deep fundamental problems that the quantum raised that had to be explained. He didn't deny them. They had to be explained. In 1911, he told the greatest physicists in the world at the first Solvay conference that the fundamental problem, the one problem that we should all be turning our attention to, is the unexplained apparent duality of wave and particle at the fundamental level of physics. He did not run away from harsh truths. He sometimes tried to overcome them, but when he found he couldn't, as in the quantum theory, he accepted them with more or less good grace and then tried to work beyond them.
Well, you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the program that he had those 20 years, his first 20 years, that run of 20 years, and had tremendous success, and including that, that magical year of 1905 with all those papers being published. What about the last part of his life? Was he, you know? I mean, one of the interesting parts I always have about Einstein is when we see pictures of Einstein, he created that Hollywood look of the nutty scientist, the mad professor, the, you know, the big hair, the floppy shoes or whatever, you know, wild-looking nutty professor. Yet that's not the guy who did all the big work, is it? The guy who did all the big work was the young guy you never saw pictures of.
Young, sexy, handsome, dynamic Einstein did great work, as I say, for 20 years. The other thing you should remember is while he was doing that great work, he went to, you know, he was leading an intense public life, much more active public life than most scientists did or do. He moved to Berlin in 1914, just before the start of the World War, and he thought he was moving to the civilized center of scientific Europe. He left in December 1932 with Berlin specifically, and Europe soon after, about to fall into the abyss. And in those 20 years, as well as in that 18-year period, in addition to doing all this extraordinary important work, he was a political activist, he was a cultural touchstone, he was a symbol, he was a figure of controversy, he was a quasi-official liberal government representative to the rest of the world. He tried to keep Germany on the path of liberal democracy. He tried to speak out in defense of oppressed minorities, not just Jews, though the Jewish cause was very important to him, all kinds of things, as well as doing this, you know, extraordinary outpouring of fundamental scientific insight.
You know, there's an
I'm sorry, go ahead, Peter.
There's an interesting moment just after the period that Tom is speaking of, where he gives a speech at Albert Hall in London, and it's jam-packed with dignitaries and people from all over come to see Einstein and some other people speak about the current world situation. And he began by talking about the horror and the slavery that awaited the world under Nazism. And then at a certain point in the speech, he pulled back and said, as if in a complete non sequitur, but I think a scientist ought to work in a lighthouse or a lightboat far out at sea, and began to think and to reflect on isolation and the quiet of an individual mind. And I think that that duality between, on the one side, a fierce engagement with the political realities that began, as Tom said, in his very young. He hated Prussian militarism even as a young teenager, all the way through his involvement, his anti-nuclear work and after World War II, and his involvement in a variety of political causes. At the same time, a sense of retreat and isolation. And I think this gets to one of your questions, Ira, which is how do we get this picture of the wild-haired, sort of adorable, isolated Einstein that serves as a kind of logo for harmless depoliticization? And in a way, there are these different Einsteins, and we are constantly picking out one piece or another. But for him, the lived reality was one of moving between these worlds, worlds of intense engagement with physics, intense engagement in his personal life, and with politics at the highest level, including getting the atomic bomb, helping to get the atomic bomb project started, and then in philosophy, and then in isolation. And I think that all of these things are present in different degrees and different moments, but they're in tension even for him.
I just have to jump in here with a station break. Yeah. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is a Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that a lot of, like Einstein's appearance towards the end, was primarily because of his disdain for worldly goods. He didn't, he could have became a rich man if he wanted to, but he certainly didn't. And he never took advantage of his fame except to try to, put himself forward as a pacifist and help certain causes and that type of thing. But he just had a disdain for money and all kinds of worldly goods, and to some degree, obviously, the disdain for combing his hair. So that's why he got the appearance of looking like a wild scientist.
But did he enjoy the role sitting those two decades at the Institute for Advanced Study there in Princeton, knowing that his thoughts are out of the mainstream of physics because physics is quantum mechanics now, and he's still thinking that quantum mechanics is not the final answer to physics?
I think he thought that, unlike most people, he could afford to do it, and he said so. He said, this is a mission that I can go on. I don't need to publish another paper mm-hmm. on what happened last week in the laboratory, I can take this wild chance that maybe there is a possibility of the kind of unification that I'm searching for. And I think that that sense of a great gamble with the last decades of his life was one that was taken, I think, fully knowing the risks of failing at it.
Of course, there's the famous the equation for the expanding universe, and you know that he put his cosmological constant back in, and he took it out, saying it was the greatest blunder of his whole career.
And now it's really important again, because we've discovered the universe's the rate of expansion of the universe is accelerating, so it's back in vogue.
Could it be that easy for him to admit something that I was that stupid, you know, that big?
He was, Wolfgang Pauli, you know, used to get furious with Einstein because he said, you know, you come up with a great theory and within a year you call it the greatest thing ever, the most beautiful theory, this and the other thing, and within a year you repudiate it. In that instance, it took him 2 years to get rid of the theory that Pauli was complaining about. But yeah, Einstein was always astonished by the beauty he could see in nature, even if his vision wasn't entirely correct at the time. And he was always perfectly willing to say, well, that one wasn't quite right, but there's another one out there. I mean, the thing that Peter, I think, was hinting at is one of the fundamental aspects of Einstein's character that actually, you know, that makes him such an engaging person to spend, you know, the kind of time you have to do a biography. I mean, everybody on this program has spent years thinking about Einstein. Why do we spend time in his company, despite the fact all the clay feet we can find in him? It's because Einstein has these moments where his clarity of purpose and the elegance of his thinking just blows you away. There's one quote that has stuck with me for the 10 or 15 years.
Quickly,
I've been thinking about Einstein. And it's just that he, in 1949, wrote a kind of autobiographical notice. He called it his own obituary. And he explained why he did science. He said, out there yonder, there was this huge world which exists independently of us human beings and which stands before us like a great external riddle. And he was entranced by that. And he said the most wonderful thing about that is it's a riddle at least partially accessible to our inspection and thinking. And that sort of grand sweep makes him a remarkable person.
I've got to grandly sweep the program to a close. We're running out of time. Thank you for joining us. Thomas Levinson, author of Einstein in Berlin, published by Bantam Books. Barry Parker, author of Einstein, The Passions of a Scientist, published by Prometheus. And Peter Gallison, Mallinckrodt Professor of History of Science. And the forthcoming author of Einstein's Clocks and Poincaré's Maps, Empires of Time, to be published by Norton this August. Thank you all for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Tim Skog is our engineer in Boston. And if you'd like to find out more about today's program, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can leave us email and also get more information. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.